in a few days for under 5-year-old and 2 weeks later. Mm-hmm. Government not telling us what's happening.
Not telling us and don't seem to have any plan.
And the end of that story of the USS St. Louis, the Jews turned back by the United States during World War II.
More than 200 of the Jews were killed in the Holocaust.
And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! To see our full coverage of the border, go to democracynow.org. Tomorrow, a special on July 4th. Hear the speech of Frederick Douglass.
Good afternoon. The time is 4:59, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. And up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host the class Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th and 4 p.m. at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally and nationally, KBOO hip hop programming, how hip hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, rhyme, writing, and production, and how liberation struggles have contributed to hip-hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th at 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
First off, they'll say what it is, a festival.
Hey, folks, I want to tell you about the first annual Best of the Northwest Vernonia Springs Music Festival. It's going to take place on July 7th, 2018. KBOO is our co-sponsor, and our headliners are Lloyd Jones and Baby Gramps.
Sometimes known as Sourdough Dolly.
Wait, you give him a purge of that good old Mountain Dew.
www.vernoniasprings.com/VSMF. To learn more, go to kboo.fm.
And people think, he's so old, he squeaks. And I will prove that.
Look for the Vernonia Springs Music Festival.
And I'd like to convert it into a bedlam of jive. Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Trump ends affirmative action.
A level 3 evacuation is now ordered for Warm Springs because of a wildfire.
And in international news, everything is awful except for when it's not, but we don't get to talk about that a whole lot. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 3rd, 2018. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Elizabeth Venable. The Trump administration plans to rescind Obama-era guidelines for affirmative action in school admissions. In 2011, the Obama administration stated that schools should encourage the enrollment of a diverse student body, with race as one factor in a holistic admissions process. This allowed schools the legal right to consider race in admissions in order to increase diversity within the student body. The Obama administration view was that all students, regardless of race, would benefit from a diverse student body. The Trump administration now wants to revert the race-neutral admissions standard that were created under President George W. Bush. The removal of these guidelines would allow schools to take a race-blind approach to their admissions decisions. While these guidelines are not considered federal law, schools that do not adhere to them could lose federal funding or even face retaliation in the form of lawsuits by the Department of Justice. In November of last year, Attorney General Jeff Sessions directed the Justice Department to reconsider past guidelines within the Education Department's Civil Rights Division. More recently, an internal Department of Justice memo disclosed plans to redirect Civil Rights Division's funding towards investigations into Obama-era administrations Obama-era admissions practices that some consider to be discriminatory. Previously, in 2016, the Supreme Court upheld the Obama-era affirmative action guidelines as constitutional. The opinion was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy. However, after Kennedy announced his resignation for later this summer, the Trump administration has the opportunity to install a new justice that may not be as supportive of affirmative action.
Civil liberties groups have condemned the Trump administration's reversal, arguing that it goes against decades of court precedent which permits schools to consider race as one factor in admission decisions. Kirsten Clark, the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, stated, quote, "We condemn the Department of Education's politically motivated attack on affirmative action and deliberate attempt to discourage colleges and universities from pursuing racial diversity at our nation's colleges and universities," unquote. Similarly, the American Council on Education, the largest higher education lobbying group in the country, stated that they will not comply with the Trump administration's reversal. The dismantling of affirmative action comes during a high-profile court case against Harvard University. The Ivy League school is defending itself from accusations that their admissions process discriminates against Asian American applicants. This lawsuit argues that the university has systematically restricted Asian American admissions in order to reserve space for students of other races. The Trump administration's Justice Department has already formed its own investigation into the university's admissions process. The new guidelines will likely play an important role in the future court proceedings of this case.
A Level 3 evacuation order, meaning leave immediately, has been issued to 50 residences in Warm Springs, Oregon. A 500-acre fire shut down Highway US 26 for about 6 hours on Monday, July 2nd. However, at 9 p.m. on Monday, the Oregon Department of Transportation reopened the highway at mile marker 105. The Assistant Fire Management Officer of the Warm Springs Tribe, William Wilson, stated to KGW that the wildfire had jumped the highway and began to burn upwards towards the houses under evacuation orders. Another group of homes has been notified that they may be soon ordered to evacuate as well. There is currently an investigation into the cause of the fire. Additionally, the Indian Head Casino and Museum at Warm Springs are both closed due to the wildfire.
And now, on the eve of our nation's Independence Day, KBOO's Al Khan has some thoughts.
Once there was a place. It was a wonderful place. Winter nights were crisp and clean, and the days were filled with snowball fights and fires. And Christmas was magic. Summers in this place lasted forever. Long hot days, cool summer evenings, and the highlight of the summer, the biggest day, was the magical 4th of July, Independence Day. The children would all run and play, and the smells of barbecue filled the air. There were all sorts of things to eat and drink, and at night, we lit up the sky. What a magical, magical place. Yet it only ever existed through the eyes of a child. The place, it seems, was not quite so magical. It was a tyranny where wars were fought to protect the business interests of the rich and powerful, and the lives of the young and the poor were thrown away with no regard. Through the years, the rich and powerful have grabbed more and more and more. Their greed is without end, and still the lives of the young are being thrown away to fill their pockets. And yes, this is what we celebrate now on Independence Day. We talk about being a nation of pride, a nation of freedom, a nation of liberty. It's all just talk. The country the child remembered would never have turned away people at their borders. No, the people come. They're seeking asylum, seeking their lives, seeking protection, would have been welcomed in and given a place to stay and treated as family and as neighbors. The nation the child saw would never have accepted slavery. The nation the child saw would never have accepted people living on the streets. The nation the child saw would never have treated our veterans as shabbily and poorly as we do. But yet, still, that nation was only through the eyes of a child. Tomorrow, we will celebrate our independence. Yet how many people are truly independent in this country? The rich, the powerful, the 1%, that control most of the wealth and all of the government. This is what we celebrate. Let freedom ring. I'm Al Khan, and I thank you for your attention.
Last October, a 21-year-old man followed a woman off a TriMet bus in southeast Portland. He then grabbed her and forced her into a nearby bushes where he hit her head on a wall and sexually assaulted her. The man, Gary Wayne Streeter Hillrick, was sentenced today to a 20-year prison sentence on charges of first-degree rape and first-degree kidnapping. Streeter Hillrick had a history of sex crimes at the time of the attack and was already on probation for similar crimes committed as a minor. According to police reports, Streeter Hillrick was on the number 4 bus downtown when the 26-year-old woman boarded. TriMet surveillance video shows him following the woman off a bus near Southeast 7th Street and Grant Avenue. The woman, whose identity has not been released, said he attacked her and told her he would stab her if she did not remain quiet. After the assault, he stole her iPhone and ran off. She was found some minutes later by a passerby who called for help. According to the plea deal, Streeter Hillrick must serve all 20 years of his sentence with no time off for good behavior.
Martha L. Walters was sworn in as Chief Justice of Oregon Supreme Court on Monday, July 2nd. Ms. Walters joined the Oregon Supreme Court in 2006 as an associate judge and had been practicing law for 30 years prior to that. With an emphasis on employment law and civil litigation, Ms. Walters will be succeeding now Associate Justice Thomas Ballmer and will be presiding over the court for the next 6 years. Ms. Walters grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and graduated from the University of Michigan with distinction in 1972. Ms. Walters then went on to graduate from the University of Oregon Law School in 1977. Ms. Walters has been a member of over 25 legal boards, committees, and task forces, notably serving as the president of the Lane County Bar from 1992 to 1993, as well as the commissioner of the Oregon Law Commission from 2003 to 2006. Another significant accomplishment of Ms. Walters is being a member of the legal team that represented professional golfer Casey Martin in PGA Tour Inc. v. Martin, PGA Tour Incorporated. This was a 2001 Supreme Court case in which Casey Martin, as a result of his inability to walk long distances due to a circulatory condition, sued the Professional Golf Association for not allowing him to use a golf cart, citing the Americans with Disabilities Act. Ms. Walters and the legal team representing Mr. Martin won the case, and the Supreme Court asserted that the PGA must allow him to use a golf cart. Following this victory, Ms. Walters wrote an article titled, quote, "When the only way to equal is to acknowledge the difference, PGA Tour Incorporated versus Martin," for the Brandeis Law Journal. The Oregon Supreme Court is a majority female bench, and according to the Oregonian, Justice Ballmer stated that it is overdue for Oregon to have a female Chief Justice. When Ms. Walters joined the court in 2006, there were no other female justices. Today there are 5. Ms. Walters has emphasized how important it is for people of Oregon to feel as though they are being listened to and properly served by the court. In turn, Ms. Walters' goal is that all Oregonians have a fair and impartial justice system.
Scott Pruitt, the Environmental Protection Agency administrator, asked President Donald Trump to fire Attorney General Jeff Sessions as head of the Department of Justice and appoint him instead. CNN.com quotes, "Trump has complained loudly and publicly about the recusal for the last 14 months and floated replacing Sessions with Pruitt as recently as April." Pruitt could replace Sessions under the Vacancies Reform Act, which grants the president the jurisdiction to fill in the vacant position in a federal agency if the person in office, quote, "dies, resigns, or is otherwise unable to perform the functions and duties of the office," says CNN.com. If Pruitt were to become the head of the Department of Justice, he would run for office in the state of Oklahoma. Trump's advisors have rejected Pruitt's proposal. Pruitt is in Trump's good graces despite the scandals involving Pruitt that have plagued Trump's administration. Trump says that Pruitt has done a good job for the EPA, but isn't completely happy with, quote-unquote, certain things. CNN.com includes that Pruitt also has aides that keep a secret schedule for him, as revealed on Monday. These secret calendars included meetings and calls with industry representatives. With Pruitt keeping secret calendars and deleting records, it is possible that this violates federal law under hiding public records or, quote, falsifying records, according to CNN.com.
Michael Cohen served as President Trump's personal attorney for many years, and during those years, he maintained a public stance of fierce loyalty to Trump. But after his properties were raided by the FBI, Cohen's stance seems to have shifted. In an exclusive interview with ABC News on Saturday, Cohen clarified where his loyalties lie. Although Cohen once claimed that he was, quote, "the guy who could take a bullet," unquote, for Trump, when asked if he would cooperate with the Mueller investigation, even if it were to prove damaging to Trump. Cohen clarified that, quote, "To be crystal clear, my wife, my daughter, and my son, and this country have my first loyalty," unquote. Cohen is currently under investigation for allegedly violating campaign finance laws as well as other financial crimes that concern his personal businesses. The main public accusation against Cohen is that he paid off Stormy Daniels only weeks before the 2016 election so that she would keep quiet about an affair with Trump. While in the past Cohen claimed that he paid Daniels of his own accord, he later shifted to an ambiguous answer, stating that, quote, "I want to answer. One day I will answer. But for now, I can't comment further on advice of my counsel," unquote. Cohen has hired Guy Petrillo, a former federal prosecutor who headed the criminal division in Manhattan for the U.S. Attorney's Office, the same office investigating Cohen.
And in his interview with ABC News on Saturday, Cohen claimed that if he were to cooperate with the Mueller investigation, it would be based on Petrillo's counsel, not on loyalty to Trump. When asked about the possibility that Trump might attack his credibility if he decides to cooperate with Mueller, Cohen stood firm. Cohen stated that, quote, "I will not be a punching bag as part of anyone's defense strategy. I am not a villain of this story, and I will not allow others to try to depict me that way," end quote. During his interview, Cohen took further steps to distance himself from Trump and his criticism of multiple ongoing federal investigations. Trump criticized the FBI's raid on Cohen's New York properties, calling it, quote, "an attack on our country in a true sense. It's an attack on what we all stand for," end quote. But Cohen disagreed with Trump's attempt to vilify the agents who conducted the raid. Cohen also rebuked the fact that Trump has used Russian President Vladimir Putin's denial of any election meddling as proof that no interference occurred. In response, Cohen warned that, quote, "simply accepting the denial of Mr. Putin is unsustainable." Cohen also stated that, quote, "I repudiate Russia's attempt to interfere or meddle in our democratic process, and I would call on all Americans to do the same." Cohen used his interview to publicly distance himself from Trump and Trump's stance on multiple federal investigations. It is unclear if Cohen really will turn up against Trump once the Mueller investigations come to a head. But if he does, it will be a damaging blow to the president, delivered by one of his longest servants.
And now it's time for Climate Connections, produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. In this episode, the teacher-friendly book on climate change.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The gold in your jewelry may be beautiful, but mining it has an ugly impact on the global climate.
If we think of gold mining, we have to dig the rock out of the ground, and digging rock out of the ground requires diesel, and processing that rock to get the gold out requires energy or electricity.
That's Gavin Mudd of RMIT University in Australia. He says mining a ton of gold emits a lot more carbon pollution than mining other metals like iron, because there's so little gold in the rock. It requires so much energy that producing a single ounce can emit 1,000 pounds of carbon pollution. That's the equivalent of driving a gas-powered car for more than 1,000 miles. Since gold is used not only in jewelry, but also in many electronic components, the ounces add up quickly.
We're getting tens of millions of tons of greenhouse gas emissions just associated with gold mining.
As mines play out and gold becomes even more rare, mining it will require even more energy. Mudd says that finding a sustainable source of biodiesel could offset the use of fossil fuels for extraction and trucking, and he's already seeing solar panels being used for processing.
Certainly for the electricity side, I think there's some really good directions happening in industry.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Up in a wilderness today, a place my mind could not remember, but my soul already knew. No longer searching for a steady breeze, there is soil on my skin and salt water in my blood. A descendant of God, I feel as if I am sunshine with a pulse. I bear my fertile flower from which humanity originates.
Rivers of milk flow from me, and I watch as entire kingdoms.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with immigration rights and labor activist Maria Damaris, who will be discussing Mexico's new president-elect, Lopez Obrador. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, we have Calculated Conversations. Tonight's weather will be cool in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, look for cloudy skies and temperatures in the lower 80s. Today in history, in 1962, Jackie Robinson became the first black player inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. The quote of the day is also from Jackie Robinson, who said, "Life is not a spectator sport. If you're going to spend your whole life in the grandstand just watching what's going on, in my opinion, you're just wasting your life."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
An ocean is
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Army Corps' Environmental Impact Statement scoping period for the proposed pebble mine in Alaska has ended. On the last day of scoping, the governor's office weighed in with a request, as Izzy Ross reports.
Governor Walker's office Friday asked the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to suspend the Environmental Impact Statement process for the proposed pebble mine. In a letter to the Army Corps, Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott contend that Pebble Limited Partnership has yet to present a feasible and realistic project. For the Corps to fully consider all alternatives in the draft EIS, they recommend a preliminary economic assessment at minimum, and preferably a pre-feasibility study. Governor Walker says that he believes the project needs to catch up to the process.
The Corps of Engineers is evaluating all the options on Pebble Mine. We want to make sure that there's sufficient opportunity for input on the actual project itself. And we felt that it wasn't far enough along really to warrant this review. I think it's appropriate for them to look at suspending the permit process until the information sort of catches up.
The letter was submitted on the final day of the EIS scoping period. According to Walker, the next step is for the Corps to decide.
Really, the next step is we don't necessarily have one administratively ourselves that I'm aware of, but really the ball's in their court at this point, how they're going to respond to the information they've received.
Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation CEO Norman Van Vactor called the decision fantastic. BBEDC has long opposed the mining project. He said in an interview with KDLG, quote, "I'm glad to see the governor and this administration and Byron Mallott step up and do it. I think it speaks to our concerns. It speaks to the fact that the Army Corps of Engineers seems to be rushing the whole permit process. There's just so many ongoing uncertainties about it. I hope and pray that the Army Corps of Engineers listens to the state," unquote. In a press release, Pebble Limited Partnership CEO Tom Collier said that the purpose of the Corps' EIS process is to evaluate Pebble's potential environmental impact, including whether it would be able to operate without harming the region's salmon habitat. He said that the governor's request to suspend this process was unclear and sees it as a stall tactic. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Over the weekend, the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska officially took over management of a troubled Indian Health Service hospital, the Sioux City Journal reports. The tribe will administer funding, hiring staff, and selecting providers. In recent years, the hospital faced several incidents, including a government report identifying life-threatening deficiencies and an incident where patients may have been exposed to disease after an instrument was not properly sterilized. The tribal council voted to initiate self-governance of the hospital in November. It provides service to about 10,000 Native Americans. A public celebration is being planned for later this month. In New Mexico, Acoma Pueblo celebrated taking over full control of its elementary school from the Bureau of Indian Education. An event was held Monday to receive keys from the BIE. The tribe is transforming education at the school to be centered around tribal language and culture. It will also focus on increasing academic achievement through science, technology, engineering, and math. The school opened in 1975. Now Acoma is the fifth Pueblo in New Mexico to take over operations from the BIE. Native young people from across the country are gearing up for the annual Unity Conference. They'll examine and discuss solutions to challenges facing their communities, including bullying, substance abuse, suicide, and environmental concerns. Youth will also take a look at business and leadership principles and preserving Native language and culture. More than 2,000 people are expected to gather in San Diego this week. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Filipino drug suspects have long been the target of Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, and now loiterers are being added to the list. Quote, "If there are people standing idly by there, they should go home," unquote, stated the Philippine Daily Inquirer on the announcement Duterte had made to Filipino authorities. The Philippine Daily Inquirer goes on to cite Duterte's response to the loiterers refusing the move. Quote, "I'll take care of it. Tie their hands together and I'll throw them in the river," unquote. Over 11,000 arrests have been made despite the Philippines' decriminalization of loitering in 2012. Duterte also claims that law enforcement were not advised to arrest unless the offenders were making a living room on the streets. For nearly a month, the Filipino authorities have been cracking down on the country's loiterers through multiple arrests. Some of the offenders are as young as 5 years old. Arrested outside of his home, 25-year-old Genesis Argencio was taken to jail on June 15th and died 4 days later during the incarceration. There is speculation about his arrest, as authorities first claimed it was because he was not wearing a shirt. Authorities also alleged that he was intoxicated and caused a public disturbance as police arrived. Authorities then stated that the young man's death was attributed to his mental health, arguing that he was completely inconsolable and, quote, making a scene inside the cell, according to ABS-CBN News. However, Argencio's family contradicts this allegation, describing him as soft-spoken and not having any mental health issues. He died from injuries to the head, chest, and neck. Argencio's death triggered a demonstration where people carried picket signs and buckets of animal blood to the Quezon City Police Headquarters. Filipino law enforcement have Duterte's full support in carrying out the arrests of loiterers. They say they will continue the anti-loitering crusade despite the controversy surrounding Argencio's case.
Racism has always been an issue in soccer, and Russia has long been the poster child for racist incidents in the sport. According to a report by the FAIR Network, which monitors racism and homophobia in European soccer, during the 2017 to 2018 season, there were 80 instances of far-right activity and racism in Russia. More specifically, there were 19 different abusive chants directed towards players this season. Last season, only 2 such chants were recorded, and the season before that, there were 10 chants recorded. Most recently, racist chants were directed towards black players on the French national team during an exhibition match in Russia in March. Before that, a youth team from Liverpool, England visited Russia for multiple youth league matches, during which many black Liverpool players were the targets of racist monkey chants from Russian fans. Such monkey chants are all too common in Russia and are especially harsh for black athletes playing in the Russian Premier League. One of the most famous black soccer players in Russia is Brazilian forward Hulk, who asserts that, quote, "almost every game I see this happening." Over many years, FIFA has continued to respond to racism in Russia with minor fines. When supporters of Russian soccer team Zenit St. Petersburg released a pamphlet calling for a white-only, heterosexual-only team, the club was fined just $1,600. Following racist chants against players on the French national team in March, the Russian Football Union was fined $22,000. In comparison, when an English soccer player drank an energy drink that was not an official sponsor for the team, the English Football Association was fined only slightly less. Since the World Cup began, the FAIR Network has reported that no major incident of racism has occurred so far. During the World Cup, the host nation often presents a clean, positive image of the country to visiting fans. According to Piara Power, head of the FAIR Network, quote, "we know that during the World Cup period, the population sort of understands that they are in the spotlight. The world is watching." Political science professor and ex-professional player Jules Boykoff has criticized FIFA's decision to award the World Cup to Russia, asserting that, quote, "FIFA is essentially franchising the practice of sport washing, gifting its signature event to authoritarian countries that use the World Cup to enhance their reputations and distract us from their horrific human rights records," end quote. During this World Cup, referees have been granted power to stop, suspend, or abandon matches in the case of discriminatory incidents, but no such action has been taken at matches thus far. Three rounds of the World Cup remain, and regardless of if the World Cup concludes without a major incident, Boykov warns that, quote, Russian football hooliganism is a festering mess of xenophobia and bigotry.
Political tensions in Germany have reached a rolling boil over the issue of immigration as Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union butts heads with German Interior Minister Horst Schäfer's Christian Social Union. The 2015 European refugee crisis marked heightened levels of asylum seeking entering the European Union. As a result, a number of EU countries were tasked with accepting these refugees. The refugee crisis politically divided nations, leaders, and citizens, with the Social Democratic lead nation of Sweden taking in 160,000 refugees, while Czech Republic Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka asserted that refugee acceptance should be completely voluntary. However, in May of 2015, EU authorities announced a number of quota plans which would require nations from the EU to block and relieve Greece and Italy of their continuous immigration stream. Although hotly contested by countries like Slovakia and Hungary, the quota system was upheld by the EU Court of Justice, excavating the divide among EU nations. While many countries took in a fair number of refugees, Germany accepted by far the most, allowing 890,000 asylum seekers to enter in 2015. Ms. Merkel's policy was initially praised in the humanitarian light, but has gone to receive criticism from far-right political groups, especially after a 2016 terrorist attack in Berlin was perpetrated by a failed asylum seeker. Despite the number of asylum seekers in Germany drastically decreasing to 280,000 in 2016 and 90,000 in 2017, anti-refugee far-right rhetoric has gotten stronger in Germany, with the movement gaining traction in the Free State of Bavaria in addition to the creation of Alternative for Germany Party. Although it is not surprising that Ms. Merkel has received heavy criticism from her political opposition, other criticism has been drawn from inside her ministry cabinet, with Interior Minister Horst Schäfer threatening to resign or impose the policies himself, subordinately, if Merkel does not close Germany's borders to secondary migrants. Mr. Seehofer is seeking to block migrants who either have no papers or have previously registered for asylum in another European Union country. Ms. Merkel, on the other hand, believes in upholding the Schengen Agreement, allowing free travel throughout European countries in the agreement without internal border checks, in an attempt to temper Mr. Seehofer and the far-right movement. On Monday, July 2nd, Ms. Merkel agreed to compromise a deal in which would establish transit centers where migrants would be screened and, if found to have applied for asylum in another EU country, would be sent back. Ms. Merkel's compromise signals a weakening in her political party's power and could, according to the New York Times, lead to a much bigger implication, such as an end to Europe's open border policy, a hard-right political shift, and even possible racial profiling at European borders.
The government of Uganda has implemented a controversial tax on citizens that use social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Skype, and WhatsApp. Users will be restricted from accessing 58 different websites, apps, and voice calling services unless they pay a tax of 200 Ugandan shillings, or about 5 cents per day. Considering that some data bundles in the country cost between 500 and 1,000 shillings, a 200 shilling tax could increase prices by up to 40%. The tax will also affect mobile payment platforms. These mobile money transactions are a popular way for Ugandans to receive their wages and make payments. The mobile payment tax is 1% of every transaction. The Ugandan parliament approved the taxes in May following President Yoweri Museveni's assertions that social media encourages gossip. However, some argue that the tax is politically motivated because it will limit public criticism of the Ugandan government online. Many also view the tax as a restriction of freedom of speech. Uganda's government has blocked internet access in the past, specifically leading up to the February 2016 elections. However, they previously had not targeted specific websites and apps. Some internet users in Uganda have turned on VPNs, or virtual private networks, which makes it appear as if you are accessing the internet from another country. However, this method increases data usage and could end up costing more than the tax itself. The Uganda Communications Commission has ordered telecom companies to block the VPNs. Lawsuits have already been filed against the government by one telecom company and various private citizens. They accused the government of breaching net neutrality principles and restricting freedom of speech. These lawsuits demand that the tax will be overturned and declared illegal. Ugandan youth have maintained that social media tax represents a continued exclusion of young people from national processes. Uganda's social media tax has already been condemned by the Human Rights Watch as well as Amnesty International.
Over 108,000 LGBT people around the world responded to an online survey that inspired the British government to begin an initiative against discrimination of the queer community. Part of this initiative against LGBT discrimination includes working on legislation to ban conversion therapy, as approximately 2% have participated in different forms of conversion therapy, while 5% were offered but never accepted. Conversion therapy can be conducted by a multitude of groups, including family members, religious groups, and healthcare professionals. The government plan states, quote, "We will fully consider all legislative and non-legislative options to prohibit promoting, offering, or conducting conversion therapy," unquote. The data also showed that a large amount of queer people say they have experienced discrimination, such as verbal attacks, harassment, and physical violence. But 90% of the LGBT survey takers have said that they chose not to report the incidents because, quote, "it happens all the time." This influenced the British government to begin taking initiative on reporting LGBT discrimination and also including anti-homophobia programs in education. The plan also involves having LGBT health advisor. The British government is also working on an LGBT implementation fund, which has around 5 million euros in order to execute the plan. And now it's time for the most mind-fracturing riddle in this side of the Mississippi. It's the point puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I left you with a math puzzle. You hold your first barbecue of the season, and two-thirds of your guests have hamburgers, half have corn on the cob, five people have both, and one person has neither. How many people are at the barbecue? Well, the answer is 24. 16 people have a hamburger, 12 have corn on the cob. With the duplicate 5 having both, that brings you to 23. One more person has neither. Our winner this week is Ralph Utes, who listens to KBOO in Portland, Oregon.
Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the damage on. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along the damage on.
In Bend here, one of our 4th of July traditions is a pet parade. So this week, I bring you a puzzle about cats and dogs. Start with two words: a wild cat and a breed of dog. Take the last three letters of each word, and you will have an N and 5 of the last 7 letters of the alphabet. So again, start with a wild cat and a breed of dog. Take the last three letters of each word, and you will have the letter N plus 5 of the last 7 letters of the alphabet. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Oh, I bite myself a little dog, and his color, it was brown. Throw him in a music box just to say.
This has been Pearl Stark with your point puzzle for the week of July 2nd. The point puzzle is produced at KPOV High Desert Community Radio.
Do the credit. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us for your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is CJ Fritz, Emmett White, Al Khan, Summer Barraza, and Yasmin Kabanoglu. The producer, engineer, and KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelis Ellis Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Elizabeth Venable. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland. At 9, The Politics of Living, Women's Voices and Opinions on Economic, Social, and Cultural Issues. At 9:30, KBOO reports live from Occupy ISPDX, interviews and updates from the encampment at Portland's Immigration Field Office. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views about cycling from Portland and beyond. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, better known as AMLO, just won the Mexican presidency and is the first leftist president in decades. He's been called a peacekeeper and a leader who is at the forefront of what many in Mexico are calling the fourth transformation or revolution. Border relations between Mexico and the U.S. have been heated, but AMLO has foregone commenting negatively on President Trump's policies. Critics have called AMLO a populist, drawing comparisons from him to Trump rhetoric. He stymied other critics who look down on his collaboration with coalitions connected to PES or Partido Encuentro Social, a national conservative political party. AMLO formally takes office in December. And we have in the studio Marino Dama. Welcome.
Hi, thank you to all the KBOO listeners. My name is Maria Damaris. You can call me many names, Maria Damaris. My students call me Mrs. Silva. The teachers call me Dama. Latinos call me Damaris, so it's not important. My name is not really important. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, sure. Very prestigious. But so for context, can you talk a bit about what separates this Mexican election from ones in the past?
Sure. We call this the fourth transformation. The first transformation started with the, decolonization of Mexico with the independence. That was with President Madero. The second transformation was with the, the Mexican Revolution, one of the bloodiest revolution for land, mostly for the claim of land, to asking the political party to redistribute the land. There was millions and millions of poor, indigenous people, especially more in the countryside. The third transformation, it was with Lázaro Cárdenas, Presidente Lázaro Cárdenas, who expropriated the French, privatized the French infrastructure of the oil in Mexico. So pretty much it was Pemex. I don't know if you are familiar with what is Pemex. So he expropriated. And then, of course, the French got mad. And then we have the Cinco de Mayo battle. But this is the fourth transformation, meaning it's the first time that the left wing party wins overwhelmingly. We have at least 63% of the people voted in Mexico, which is an unprecedented numbers of people voting because they've been abstaining for so long. Also, it's been 90 years of the main political party, which is more like the Democrats in this country. And also, there was two sexenios, two six-term presidency of the right-wing conservatives, which it will be more like the Republicans. Mm-hmm. And then they went back to the, to the liberals, the Democrats. And now we have someone that you guys probably don't know, more like the Green Party. I don't know. It's hard to compare, but this is the left-wing,
okay,
very populist, you know, President AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is winning with 53% of the vote, and the, his opponents are like 15%, and then the, you know, the PRI, which is the current government, only 15% of the vote, and then 23% of the right conservatives. And also there was an independent who actually wanted to cut the hands of the people that the steals.
I heard about this.
El Mochamanos.
The footage of that is wild. Yeah.
I was wild. That was really wild. It was very crazy. He got 5% of the vote, so.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So this is very, very unprecedented. You know, currently I'm just sobbing. I'm the state coordinator of Morena. And of course, our new president, who were waiting just to be, you know, recognized by the INE, the institutional national electoral, you know, institution, to recognize him so he can start, you know, assigning more people to work with him. I don't know if I'm going to be working with him as a rep here in Oregon. I'm just subbing for Eduardo Corona, who he is the rep for the coordinator of the committees here for the state of Oregon. And I'm just helping to sub, you know, I'm just very passionate. All this done in a volunteer basis. We work a lot in the campaigns. We have no money. We here in the United States, we were not able actually to donate money to the Morena Party, which is the political new party. It's a three-year-old new party, which means Morena stands for movimiento, and then R-E-R-E means it means transformation. You can also call it renovation, and then the acronym of N-A means national. So it's actually is the first also who is also the first party that is not carrying the party acronyms, but he's is actually carrying the you know, a name of the representative movement of people.
Mm-hmm. Now, his history as a candidate, or his history as a person, really, how does it align with his campaign message? Like, where do they cross over? Or, like, what has he been doing before the election, before he ran, and how does what he said in the campaign align with that?
Yeah. Well, he's very ethical. He's been working for at least 20 years for the people of Mexico. He was previously in other political parties, the left wing, more kind of like moderate, is called PRD. He's really strong in honesty, transparency, and also peacemaking. He's actually calling Mexico for reconciliation, which is a very, to me, it's a very strong term, because I do work a lot in the nonviolence. I'm actually the detention teacher at one of the schools in Vancouver. I'll tell you the name. Hopefully I won't get in trouble, but I'm the detention teacher at the Vancouver School District. I work with a certified teacher there. But to me, reconciliation is part of the restorative process for any person to become as a whole. So when I hear AMLO saying publicly yesterday, today, and before the campaign, how important it is for us to heal from all these, you know, 90 years, decades and decades of abuse and thief and violence, you know, is very important, very interesting. I actually know that there is some challenges. There is some political controversies from the LGBT community. I'm a very strong ally of the LGBT. I've been working, you know, in support of the rights for many years. And I know that the head of the state, that is a woman, Claudia Sheinbaum, she's one of the most influential people in Mexico City, where a lot of the transformation for gay, LGBT, gay people started when AMLO, that's how we call him, was the head of the state at that time. So he has pronounced himself. It's very hard for him to, you know, take any positions, because he has actually formed a coalition with some of the right-wing movement groups, parties, and
yes.
Yeah, with the PES and the PETE, but it's more like the El Partido de Encuentro Social, right wing. But he has been very clear, you know, he's been very clear since the beginning. He's been holding the LGBT flag, and he has said we will respect everyone's individuality. We will respect everyone's sexual orientation. We will respect everyone's, you know, freedom of expression, whether it's sexual or not. And then the head of state, Claudia Sheinbaum, also, she has, you know, say that enough with the phobias, you know. Am I saying it right?
Oh, yeah, phobia.
Enough with the phobias. We are the strong allies of the LGBT. So it's hard when you're trying to make history and you are trying to, you know, bring everyone together to pronounce yourself in a way that we want, right? I want him to say the F word to Donald Trump personally, right? Because we have directly been affected by the hate of the people, by some of the people here in the United States and by the Donald Trump policies.
I was going to ask, what do you think AMLO will specifically contribute to the U.S.-Mexican border crisis we're going through now?
Sure. I'm involved voluntarily because AMLO promised to turn the Mexican consulate into it's like a DA's office in support of the immigrant workers, not only to take claims but also to actually put them to work. You know, I personally have a negative experience with the Mexican consulate. I think they're just getting a paycheck. I've been personally, you know, involved with a lot of people who have been at the Mexican consulate, you know, especially here in Portland, and they haven't done much to help them, right? And I think Latinos, especially, you know, undocumented immigrants who are the ones that suffer the most abuse, yet they pay taxes and they work so hard, they're the less represented here in the United States. So he has pledged to work with the consulate and make them to work in support of the immigrant workers. He's not going to pay for the wall for sure. He definitely, you know, wants to work with Trump in terms of, you know, bringing investment to Mexico, not necessarily with him, but he understands that much of the problem in Mexico is the poverty, the extreme poverty that the Mexican people have been living. And he actually is the first president that wants to keep Mexicans in Mexico, in their national origins, so we can be working, studying, and contributing to our own country so we won't have to migrate to the United States. I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does.
Yeah.
Now, what's Mexico's history with voter fraud and voter buyout? Because there's some speculation about that I've heard. Can you talk more about that, or if it's all hot air?
Sure. Yeah, hopefully, you know, Cable will air the interview we have with, you know, Annie was so nice last Saturday in the morning, sacrificed her Saturday morning just to come with me and record the interview with Hector Vasconcelos. Hector Vasconcelos was actually appointed to be the Secretary of the Exterior. You know, he's been working with Morena, and he also was appointed as one of the Exterior Secretaries. And we did ask him the questions about you know, his work as part of the international observers orientations that he gave last Saturday. AMLO have run for president. This is the third time. The last two times there was fraud. It was for sure. The first time he ran, I think it was 2006. There was actually fraud, and it was so much violence. You know, remember that at that time the Conservative Party, PAN, was in place, and they promised the people to get rid of the insecurity and get rid of the violence by fighting crime, the drug war, right? So we all know that all those are failed policies, that you don't fight a drug war when the whole nation of Mexico is, you know, in poverty, when there is only 7% of the people who are rich, you know, who have a lot, and then 90% of the people have nothing. So there was a lot of violence, a lot of disappearing, lots of killings of journalists. I know organizations like Global Exchange and Amnesty International, who have sent international observers to Mexico in the past, didn't send then the following election, which was, I think it was 2012, where it was a very obvious, you know, electoral fraud. And there is an electoral fraud so far now in today's election. President-elected AMLO has said that he's going to let the authorities that have to be working in resolving these problems and taking these claims, specifically the issues in Puebla, where there was, from the mafia government, people coming with guns to take and steal all the ballots, burn the ballots. I mean, there is videos in the social media everywhere where it's very obvious, and the PAN, taking credit for the senatorship, and for the Senate, and there is other cases there. So, but it is not easy. I mean, when you are an international observer, you're paying for all your expenses, so it's not that easy. In this election, we had at least 42 who committed to not to support Morena, but to be hosted by Morena, and to work in documenting, any atrocities. There was some incidents, but in general, it was an amazing amount of people that overwhelmingly voted everywhere, that it helped a lot to prevent, a lot of the fraud that could happen. But of course, the Mexican government have lied, cheated, killed. They have committed fraud in many, many ways. So it is normal, we as Mexicans, to see that fraud again.
Mm-hmm. And you've talked about his many plans for reconciliation. Do you know his concrete first steps for that once he takes office in December?
Yes. He met today with the current president. Ernesto Peña Nieto. I don't like him. It's like Donald Trump. I want to say the F word every time I think about these both presidents. But of course, I have to learn from our new elected president, about how, loving and caring he is, even when he expresses himself. And I think that's something that we'll have to learn. He's starting to meet with people in his team. He's going to give autonomy and support not only to his team, but also to the Senate and to the legislators, local and federal legislators, to work. In the past, it was more like, the Senate and the legislators answer to the president. So it was more like and he actually, even though he's elected from now to 2024, he's gonna have to change the constitution, amend the constitution, so he can be called on an election in 3 years, and then ask the people if they want him to run again. But the first step, there is many. He mentioned today at the National Palace, where he was hosted by the current president, that he wants to double the pensions of the elders. That's number one. He wants to give a pension to all the people with disabilities. And it's interesting because there is not much registration for them. I mean, we have thousands and thousands of people living with disabilities, and there is not an efficient system to ID them and to give them benefits. So that's the first thing he's going to do once he comes to power. And in the beginning of December, he also is going to give at least 30,000 scholarships. He wants to give scholarships to every single student who is in this context in US. It will be like middle school and high school students, so they won't have to give up their school to start working to support their family or to immigrate to the United States. And I think that's something very, very important, that he's the eldest of all the candidates that were running for president, but he's actually the most loved by the students, because he understands that the way to improve the country is fighting poverty and and funding education and health. He's also going to work with the teachers union also.
Mm-hmm. And in our last minute, do you want to talk about the work you're doing specifically?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned before, I'm just the spokesperson for in the state of Oregon for Morena. And but there is, I will say, dozens and dozens of amazing farm workers, people, also workers here in Portland. Also, we have committees in Woodburn, in Salem, in Portland, in Vancouver, North Portland. I mean, I could give the names Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, Benito Juarez, Kenby. We meet every week. It's more, we're trying to create a more like a grassroots movement that is not a political party, even though we are, but it's more like a movement where we are the eyes of AMLO hitting the exterior in the United States. So we invite everybody who wants to participate. There is no limits. You won't be able to vote for sure because we only Mexicans can vote in the following election in the future in 3 years, but everyone is invited. So just Google me on Facebook or in Instagram, Twitter, or in WhatsApp.
Right,
Morena,
perfect.
Oregon. Thank
perfect.
You.
Perfect. Ramirez, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yes, thank you.
Good evening. The time is 5:58. You are listening to the one, the only KBOO Portland. And up next is Transpositive PTX.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 31st Annual Waterfront Blues Festival taking place from July 4th through July 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. Performing artists this year include Beth Hart, Robert Randolph, and the Family Band, Ruthie Foster, and the Mavericks, as well as annual traditions like the Bill Rhodes Harmonica Blow-Off, Zydeco Dance Lessons, Blue Cruises, After Parties, and much more. Again, that's the 31st Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 4th through July 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.